I've worked with for 14 years, and I think the leading management or professor part was a welcome but unadded addition in my own bio. I didn't actually put it in there, but thanks for the extra props. I am just a contributing prof there. But I do teach one of the few competitive intelligence courses on the West Coast. I've also been doing entrepreneurship here for 14 years, and our first company we did grow and sell. So the talk today is on competitive intelligence frameworks, which we've kind of affectionately entitled Framework Fight Club. I've got our contact information here at the bottom. We've got a lot to cover in a little bit of time, but a couple things I want to reiterate, talk about now and reiterate later. One, we have a whole host of resources to point you to about learning frameworks and all kinds of things that we'll talk about at the end of the talk. For joining, everyone gets a free copy of our latest book. I'll tell you how to get that at the end of the talk. And we'll obviously leave a little bit of time for questions at the end, but if we run off of time, obviously feel free to email us or call us at any time. Some kind of obligatory copyright info here and contact info. The very first thing that I think any good analyst needs to be able to do, and you know, from the bio, folks probably have some understanding, right, that we own a competitive intelligence firm. We do also a lot of competitive strategy work with our clients. Client list includes guys like Merck and 3M and, you know, Microsoft and Cisco and whatever, and I could go on, and some small and medium-sized folks that we work with too. And probably the thing that I see as most important for folks to be able to gather in as a skill, if they're going to be an effective analyst as opposed to just an information collector, is the ability to recognize patterns. If you can't recognize patterns in your industry and then on top of it have a way to describe that as kind of, you know, an industry standard or a business standard, you're always going to be a little bit hampered in doing the analysis. On the other hand, this is something you can completely learn, right? I teach MBA students these kinds of things all the time. I teach our corporate clients this all the time when we do on-site workshops and trainings, which we do a lot. In short, we love to teach and mentor, too, as well as do the consulting. And so, you know, this is a totally learnable skill. There's no mystery to this. It's just that it takes time, and it usually takes at least a home industry that you kind of grow this skill in initially, because it's much more accelerated if you kind of know an industry so you can kind of recognize something's happening, and then you've got to go find the label for it, than as opposed to kind of not knowing any industries all that well and kind of trying to be this uber generalist. That usually doesn't work out too well. And there's a guy that we'll talk a little bit about again later in the talk here, Adrian, that he had a great way of describing it in his book, Value Migration, that we'll get back to a little bit later. Very first thing here, though, to put this in even a little more additional context, I'm a baseball coach. This is a short story. I love baseball. I grew up in the Midwest, and I coach my kids' teams. I now live on the West Coast. For a while, I was even a VP of a baseball league. There's an interesting thing that happens every time I teach kids baseball, which is that they neglect to watch the seams of the baseball as it comes toward them. This is a fundamental skill in baseball, and we'll get exactly in a minute here to kind of a business analogy for this. If you don't watch the seams, you can't tell if this is a curveball or fastball. And if you haven't ever played baseball or you don't even know the lick about baseball, just think about this. A curveball drops 3 feet and 60 inches if it's a really good curveball and it's been thrown at 90-plus miles an hour perhaps, or at least 80. That's a hard ball to hit if it's going to drop 3 feet and you don't know what's going to happen. So if you can watch the rotation of the ball, you'll know what's about to happen. So I'm always yelling from the dugout, watch the seams, not because I'm throwing curveballs to nine-year-olds, but because I want them to understand a skill that they need to leverage later in life. The problem is, though, that there's a million distractions, and I see this all the time. There's the umpires when you get up to other levels, like, you know, 9- and 10-year-olds, you know, beyond t-ball. There's parents who are offering helpful advice. One of my favorite times coaching t-ball, as a memory on this, is I had 7 different parents right from the dugout, right behind the dugout, offer suggestions to my little t-baller, one of the kids on my team, before I could even throw the ball at him. You know, this is like real life. This is like getting 200 emails before 6 a.m., right? This is like rolling off an 11 o'clock phone call at night and then having to be in the office at 5 in the morning. It's very hard to do good analytical work if you're constantly just drowning in the data that you're receiving. And that's very analogous to these kids. all the while, they're having trouble just focusing on the goal, which is getting to first. When you're nine, you're not trying to hit home runs. You're just trying to get to first base. The reality is, in business, it's very similar. Sometimes the goal is to get your analysis efforts just to first base, not necessarily crack a home run and tell the company its entire strategy in one slide. Now, we'll talk about some frameworks that actually lend themselves to those kinds of objectives, triples and home runs. But the fact is, the starting of building up your pattern framework is just singles and doubles and just trying to get beyond the data. So at the end of the day, you've got to watch the seams. You've got to focus on that ball, that industry event that's coming to you, and ask yourself, what pattern am I seeing? And what we can learn from a nine-year-old? Well, we can learn that basically we need to remove the extraneous. We need to analyze on what data we collect. And we need to have coaches who can give us the tools to ignore what doesn't matter and focus on what does. Now, this audience, probably more than most that I talk to, because I give this talk and other talks to lots of different folks in the States and worldwide, understand that the amount of data that's out there is rapidly increasing, right? We even have a book that now in its third edition that talks squarely about how people can go leverage this kind of stuff. That's what Going Beyond Google was about and why we created it to begin with. Because we knew there was all kinds of data out there that was, you know, look at job postings as data and look at, you know, document repositories online like SlideShare as data, and go look at federal repositories for information if your competitor's done work with the federal government. You know, all kinds of things. And that's just barely scratching the surface on the types of things, right? So the challenge with this, though, is that all the data in the world is not going to spontaneously combust into an insight. There's no spreadsheet that by itself truly delivers insight. There's some wrapper on it. There's some context that basically communicates what insight you want. And so at the end of the day, you need tools to get there. So here's an example, right? In short, the why impacts your research more than the how. So when you talk about something like the iPhone, right? The iPhone is a canonical thing that I'm sure everybody in the call at least knows about. You don't have to actually own one to know kind of what we're talking about here. You know, the iPhone's been around now for five iterations. And when it recently launched in its fifth iteration, analysts were trying to understand why the thing actually had a decent-sized sales bump for something that had felt like it was in its fifth iteration. We've done a lot of smartphone analysis and tablet analysis with our clients, so I'm kind of shorthanding some of this. But the moral of the story is, at the end of the day, you have to have a way of describing what happened to the iPhone, using kind of dictionary definition, business-defined ways of describing the event. So you don't just argue about it in generality. So you can say it was a disruptive innovation or not at that level. You can say, did the iPhone sell 5 million units because it essentially attracted the late majority and conservatives? Were you able to say what the key four success factors might be for its success over the next couple iterations, right? And the reason I'm using this terminology is it flows directly in line with certain standard canonical frameworks that you can use to analyze a market, an industry, or a competitor. So pattern recognition, in short, provides foresight and framing. So foresight is kind of the thing that almost gets overemphasized, right? You know, there's only so many people that are actually good at predicting the future. I mean, it's a simple fact. Some people are wired and able to do that more effectively. And it has a lot to do with intuition. It has a lot to do with an ability to kind of pull things together from the separate sources and kind of see where they're headed. It's not a skill everyone has, but you can amplify what you do have by using frameworks to kind of force your thinking down certain channels. Framing, though, is something that all of these frameworks can basically support. Everybody who basically builds almost any kind of business deliverable today has a similar pain point at one level. How can I get it on fewer slides? How can I get it to one slide or two slides or three slides? Because I have to, you know, send this up or over to like a team that I work with, right? And it's a classic thing we hear whenever we do training. And one of the good things about these frameworks, or really any of these frameworks, is that they tend to synthesize the data down into something that sometimes can be just put on a slide or two. And so it has kind of an additional benefit from that perspective. One of the earliest kind of frameworks to consider, and one of the more simpler ones to kind of, you know, get your head around, is something called the OODA framework. And OODA was invented, in a sense, by a guy named Boyd, who initially was in the military and then worked for the military as a contractor, if I remember the story right. And he talked about kind of this really elegant and beautiful model for describing kind of a competitive dynamic. And we'll pull this together about how it works for business here in just a sec. Basically, he said that when two enemies face off, they have to observe each other, orient each other, decide what to do, and then act. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the model that always jumps out to my MBA students is, and I always get a question on this, it seems, why is there a difference between decide and act? Which always makes me laugh a little bit, because if you've worked in a large enough company, you know why there's a difference between decide and act. Lots of organizations can decide and never act. And so what Boyd's kind of insight was is that if I go through this loop faster than someone else, I'll shoot them down. So he built a bunch of fighter jets, a second evolution of fighter jets that basically were very different than the ones that came before. When I say built, I meant more designed and kind of helped foster. It's a long, long process, you know, to kind of get it all to come about. But in business, this happens a lot. This is the case where you're trying to describe a smaller upstart competitor who's threatening a larger company. They're processing through this loop faster, in essence. So our hope is that we're working for a company that's basically a rocket, right? It's grooving through this OODA loop. You observe things, you orient things, you decide, you act. I think this is kind of what a lot of entrepreneurs kind of envision themselves to be, right? A lot of small and medium-sized companies envision themselves as still having this in their makeup. And in many cases, they do. It's the thing that lets them survive, right? It's the thing that lets them kind of change and adopt, even though they don't have maybe the resources of a larger company. Although, no matter what size company you are, there's always a little bit of fear that you're basically the manatee on the right. If you go look up top 10 slowest animals on the planet on Google, this is one of the images that comes up for good reason. The manatee is awful cute, but it's also awful slow. And the fact is, it's difficult to find ways to have this conversation effectively sometimes unless you have a framework to wrap your discussion. You just end up arguing about how fast we should move or how slow we should move. So here's some examples of basically taking the OODA loop and applying it to things that people have probably heard said in companies they've either worked with or for over the years, right? We'll have to wait till next fiscal year to provide a competing solution. You have a longer OODA loop. Now that we've launched the product, we're going to focus on demand generation, not CI. You have a longer OODA loop because, in this case, you're not observing and orienting to the market anymore. So it's hard to decide and act if you're not observing and orienting to what competitors are doing. I know what they would do. I used to work there. Well, this is one of my favorites because there's always seems to be someone who says, I know the competitor because I worked there 2 years ago. I mean, respectfully, you only know so much at that point because you've been gone for a while. They must have changed. Your ability to observe and even orient to kind of what kind of company they are might have radically changed in a couple years, right? That business unit you're in might have a new boss, it might have a new structure, it might have a new charter, all kinds of things, right? And then you've got an organization who's deciding and acting kind of on the wrong data. We'll be able to execute on that as soon as the reorg settles. Classic one, right? We have a client of ours that we work with a lot of their business groups, but one of their business groups, I swear, is going through a 13-month reorg cycle where it seems every time that we chat with them, they're getting yet another reorg and they're all sad about it. You know, this is a longer OODA loop. Whoever competes with that portion of the company, whatever other small or medium-sized company is probably having a field day. They may not even be able to describe why, but it may be fundamentally that they're able to process through observing, orienting, deciding, and acting on their decisions much faster than essentially who they're competing with. So the question in this realm is basically, you know, are you the rocket or the manatee? And, you know, using the OODA loop, you can have kind of a standard framework for saying, how well do we go through these four steps? And how well does this product group do that? And how well are decisions kind of vetted through this? So another thing that we want to talk about, though, is kind of describing what I refer to as the dots on the window, right? Companies have this as a problem all the time. They essentially look outward and they see something on the horizon that they're worried about. And they can't really determine entirely whether is it a threat, is it an opportunity, is it something to ignore. And I always add that in. There are some organizations that basically are genetically predisposed to say, ignore, we're great. Okay, that's worked for most companies up until the point you're not. you know, the fact is, though, there is a time to say at least ignore for now, because there are also companies who are always almost scared of their own shadow. They're constantly thinking the small and medium-sized guy is a threat, and they invest massive amounts of resources, right, to go do intelligence and research on that company. Sometimes the answer is you shouldn't. So you need some kind of framework to have that conversation, right? And fortunately, there's a really great one that a guy, Clayton Christensen, put up that we're going to talk about a little bit in the context of something called 3D printing. So if you're not familiar with 3D printing, it's almost even a misnomer to call it printing, basically is the creation of a physical object in a printer. So you go out and you basically create everything from, you know, you could make a plastic wall hanger, you could make a espresso cup and order it from an outfit called Shapeways that'll kind of print it on demand. You can print a model instead of actually making one. You can even print a wedding ring from this site. Not that I would recommend this as a great way to make a proposal, but the point is that these sites exist and they'll let you do this. You can also buy these things for as low as about $2,000. There's a company, MakerBot, that makes them. The university I teach at uses one in the design thinking class. The students come up with a design that they want to market and sell, and they actually print it and make it. And to show you how far this has come, not only has it been picked up a lot by the mainstream press this year, but Staples just the other day, like as short as I think a week ago, launched an initiative in Belgium that will, I think, roll out sometime in Feb, where you'll be able to order stuff through Staples and they will print it for you. Now, this is really smart if you're thinking about it from Staples' perspective because of the type of customer they have and that kind of thing. But another way of looking at this is, you know, it's almost as if your entire junk drawer, small physical objects could just be printed on demand. It changes supply chains. Lord knows what Amazon will do when they take add to cart and attach it to something like this. So it's a classic market disruptor. Most importantly, the areas it's going to disrupt are unlikely to be traditional printing. It's another reason it's a classic disruptor in a market, right? You know, you're not going to change how you print your resume. You're not going to change how you print a paper if you're in school. You're not going to change how you print a report. I don't print a lot anymore necessarily, but still I know people do. And, you know, this isn't going to necessarily disrupt that. So Clayton Christensen said, if you're facing something like this, there's a couple ways to look at it. In the book Innovator's Dilemma and Innovator's Solution, he talked about essentially a disruptive product. And he said, it either enters your market at a lower price point with different criterion essentially for its value, or it enters and feasts on a group that was focused on non-consumption. And the second one is actually one he missed in the first book and had to write a second book to cover it. And the examples for this, there are, you know, there's a ton of them, and I'll pull up a slide of a few more when we get a few more slides ahead. But here's two simple examples to talk about. One, Google Docs. Google Docs is a classic example of cheaper and does the job, right? As Christensen said, every product has a job to do. So you can analyze a competitor or an industry and say, what job does my company's product do or my organization do, and what other things might supplant that job, right? It's kind of analogous in some ways at this level of the analysis to kind of thinking about substitutes in a Porter's analysis. But then you can also think about products that cost more and compete with non-consumption. So these are usually a little harder to tease out because they start with non-consumption and then they move over into your value network. So the reason I talk about the microwave is, you know, I'm 42, so I didn't grow up with a microwave from the day I was born. I think they showed up in my house when I was like 11 or something like that. And so microwaves, though, were more expensive than necessarily a reasonably priced oven even. So what happened was, in that case, people looked at what was happening and said, I can't consume dinner in a hurry if I've got to go out to an evening event. I got to go off to a soccer event, a school event, or whatever, because it takes the time to cook a whole dinner in an oven. So they would go buy food from Mickey D's or McDonald's or Burger King or whatever on the way. They would essentially non-consume dinner at home. And so what would happen then is, though, they would be willing to buy a more expensive thing, a microwave, and essentially then give themselves the option to consume dinner at home in a much more efficient way. Here's another analogy just along the same lines. we bought smartphones and tablets in addition to regular laptops because they gave us the ability to access the internet and all the things that that provides, email and websites and all that kind of stuff, while driving, while mobile. And we were willing to pay a premium to do that. And then those devices came back and ended up disrupting the thing that has been disrupted a lot by these devices, which are PCs and laptops, right? And so this is a classic case of non-consumption as a threat. So sustaining and disruptive technologies are a little further defined here. So I won't go into these in detail because I don't want to necessarily read you all the bullets. You can take a look at them as we go through. And what's the story arc of this? I mean, if you wanted to follow it, right, because we've defined it, well, in terms of following it back to its source, this is how it traditionally looks. So there's some interesting things out of this. One, Christensen found that a lot of times the disruptive technologies are developed in your own firm to begin with, which is kind of frightening at one level. And the reason that they don't get fully developed initially is people in a larger company look at it and say, there's not enough of a market here. There's not enough of a market for 3D printers. There just isn't. We can't make enough sales. So we won't create 3D printers, says somebody like HP, at least not yet for the mass market. But somebody like MakerBot, who only gets happy if they, who's completely happy if they sell 10 printers a week, they'll make as many as they can. And those are the guys that kind of grow somewhere just off your radar sometimes, and they're the ones that create the disruption. And then eventually this product, as you can see here through the story arc, moves up market, established firms try to defend, and then we have the typical market disruptions that you'll see. This has happened time and time again. Bell Telephone, just to pick one example off this slide, their original telephone could only go 3 miles. Now, if you're Western Union back in the day, this is laughable. You have a coast-to-coast telegraph network. Who in the world needs something that only goes 3 miles? Well, it's also kind of laughable to actually have to send a telegram half a mile away to ask if you have a cup of sugar. So it made a lot more sense to actually use a phone. And we all know what won out, phones or telegrams. So, and this has happened time and time and time again, where something kind of grows in an area that the existing organization almost dismisses, and then it leaps over in this space to be a competitor. Or it just simply eats away at the bottom level, like a Google Docs, and then slowly moves its way up. So that's one example. Well, really, we're down to a few actually by now. But what if you want to chart multiple futures? What if that's the problem, right? It's not about picking one future, but it's several. And this is a classic problem that a lot of organizations go through, right? They focus in on saying, this will happen. I mean, the planning process itself almost drives people to do this, right? It's like you have to write up a document, and you have to say what you will do. Now, the framework we're going to talk about doesn't leave you hanging in terms of what you should do. It just uses a very different model to get there, one that's actually more likely to generate good outcomes almost regardless of what happens across a few different possibilities. And this is important because, as I mentioned earlier, people have a hard time essentially predicting the truth, you know, the future. They have a hard time doing this. It's not an innate skill everybody has. And here's some classic examples of people who've had a little trouble in this regard. Bill Gates once told the whole world, you all need less than even 1 megabyte of memory. I think everybody owns a USB stick that has more memory than that right now. You know, Fred Astaire was told essentially, well, studio executive, I don't know if he told Fred Astaire directly this quote, but said, you know, you can't act, you can't sing, balding can dance a little, when he reacted to Fred Astaire. Obviously, Fred Astaire did fine. The Beatles were turned down. Phil Wrigley of the Cubs said that there's no reason to do night baseball. I think the Cubs eventually had to cave, having grown up a Cubs fan, and so on and so on. The reason this happens in part in business, though, is that managers tend to look backwards. Part of that's because that's how they're measured. Metrics are historical. There's been a bunch of studies that show that only a very limited amount of time is really spent on analyzing the future and creating kind of a collective vision of it. And so all of this hampers our ability to do anything more than just say this future, as opposed to what are multiple futures and what's the best bets that I should place. So scenario planning lets us do that, right? And it's a great technique that involves a lot of data collection if you're into that. Obviously, and it's a great, and you need to support it with a lot of data, But at the end, your goal is to not pick one future but several. And it has a long-standing history. It goes all the way back to the Cold War. Was also put in place by Shell from a business standpoint when they were trying to essentially look and say, well, 30 years of oil reserves, how do I plot this out? I can't know for certain what's going to happen. And that was a good decision by Shell. And to this day, they'll publish I guess what you'd have to assume are slightly redacted versions of some of the scenario planning they've done about the global energy industry, and they publish them as documents you can download, and they kind of show what they think about for at least the scenarios in that form. There's other organizations that do this. The Army Corps of Engineers do it. There's a lot of UN agencies that use this model. The good news is you don't have to use it on a 30-year time horizon. Most of the time when we work with clients, it's somewhere between 1 year, 2 years, sometimes 5 year scenario planning, and it's for real-world business problems. You know, what should we launch as a product? What might our competitor do? What will the market do? What will the industry do? What will government do? What's all kinds of things that are just classic things that a business would worry about. So why scenario planning over some other frameworks? Well, in short, scenarios communicate a vast amount of information in a story. You know, it's like if you went around the world almost, to almost any place, given the ubiquity of Star Wars knowledge, of those three first movies, you could ask people what are the general plot lines, and most people would know. And the reason that works is because it's a story. But if you asked anyone to tell you some piece of detail out of the actual kind of list of actors that were kind of, you know, in the closing credits, or the people, even worse yet, who worked on the movie, you know, the lighting folks and whatever, nobody remembers any of that stuff except some crazy obsessed Star Wars junkie. And so that's the difference between data and story. So if you can find some framework that essentially generates stories out of the data and you know the stories are solid, well, then that has to have a certain power in the organization being able to communicate effectively, right, and reduce the cost of information transfer. So that's why people use scenario planning, beyond the fact that it helps you kind of look at the future a little differently. How do you go about doing this? Well, the very first thing is you have to have, in essence, a big question, right? This is, you don't ask a question that the answer is going to show up a week from now. You essentially go about finding a question that has some moderate term impact, right? So should we retain our current value proposition? How will rivals react to X or Y? What futures do we need to probe, right? Those kinds of things. And then you have to have a time frame. The time frame is really, really critical because it's going to funnel all of your data collection, all of the data collection you do for trends and uncertainties and those kinds of things, and we're going to talk about them right next. That's going to be scoped by the time frame. So you have to say, like, is this a question that we're trying to see what's going to happen in 18 months, 24 months, 36 months, 5 years, et cetera. The next thing you do is you look for trends. And the trends are those things that are highly impactful to the scope and highly trendable. So if you like spreadsheets, if you like quant data, if you like, this is your area, right? Your goal is to basically find those things that you can chart, you can graph, that you can pretend what's going to happen. And critical, though, it's not just a wild goose chase, goose chase for data. You have to find things that are highly impactful to the scope and highly likely to occur. So when I'm doing a workshop with somebody in this, it's usually the question I keep asking is, that's a great piece of data, does it impact the question, right? And obviously in most cases it does, because otherwise they wouldn't have brought it up, but sometimes we throw it out because it doesn't really actually impact the question. And a classic place to kind of model this up, classic way to do it, is to use Porter's Five Forces. You go through, suppliers, new entrants, buyers, rivals, etc., and you walk through that to build out some observations about the market, which tend to tell you specific trend data. And obviously, you do your own research, you pull your customer studies, all the normal things that you might have available to you to essentially throw data into the bucket. Next, you come up with uncertainties. The uncertainties are brought in by a lot of different kind of inputs. One may be everything from, interviewing experts like Delphi studies and the like. You may just individually interview people in the company, management, leadership, et cetera, to see what they think are uncertainties. And what you're always asking them is, what might impact my question? Highly impactful to it, right? Time and the question itself, but it's somewhat uncertain. And this can be a little hard sometimes for folks to kind of, you know, really zero in on. But what we're talking about here are those things that you know it has impact, but the degree of impact is somewhat unknown. It's kind of the easiest way to think about it, right? So we have a client who does a lot of work in the building industry. That's one of our clients. And they might be concerned, let's say, about the impact of building codes changing in some particular area or in some particular way, right? Just to keep it general, not to disclose anything specific about a client. And they may then wonder how far this will go. Will the building codes be excessive in this particular region of the country? Will they be light? And that's a classic case of an uncertainty that you want to have kind of a high and lower bound to. And you also might pull these together from doing kind of a PESTEL or PEST analysis or the derivatives of that. Those frameworks force you to look in turn at things like political, economic, societal, technological, legal issues, right, ecological issues. And you kind of pick your framework here a little bit based on kind of what industry you're in. Obviously, in some industries, ecological is massive. You know, I had a student this semester that was really interested in the wind and solar industry. Okay, obviously that's kind of a big driving force at a meta-narrative level for these guys, right? Also would be government for somebody who's looking at that, because government funding is really driving at least a reasonable portion of that industry's growth right now until it reaches kind of a little more stable playing ground. So you'd be looking for these uncertainties to pull them together. And so there's kind of how PEST and PESTEL and STEER kind of break down as acronyms. Then you go ahead and build your scenarios. So you have to leverage your top two uncertainties, and there's ways to rank these. I don't have time in this press to get into it, but we've got a lot of methodologies when we're with a client to say, you know, okay, you've got 10 uncertainties or 20 uncertainties or whatever. Let's walk you through ranking these in kind of a meaningful way, because you want to get to the top two that are going to kind of impact your question. And then you make a grid off of that, and I'll pull up a slide here in a minute to show you what that looks like. But once the grid is done, for each intersection, you have four at this point, you say, well, you know, I need a descriptive name for this scenario because I'm charting this story. I need to talk about things like what customers and partners and suppliers might be affected. I need to think about, is this a winning or losing scenario for us? May we see new entrants or substitutes arise? Those kinds of things, right? And the creativity really matters because it gives you a strong story to share with the rest of the organization, and it almost forces people to play ball with it, because if it's somewhat evocative, they feel like they have to either agree or disagree with it, which is what you want. You want actual dialogue on these scenarios. Just the same reason Shell and the Army Corps of Engineers, even those two organizations, had at least slightly colorful ways of describing their scenarios they've made available publicly. Where you get massive business benefit out of this is this next step. For each scenario in turn, you describe what key success factors you would need to kind of grab hold of to survive in that world. So if you have a question that has an 18-month time horizon, you go through and say, okay, after we've collected all the data, all the trends, and all the uncertainties, and we've figured out what our issues are, and we feel this scenario is supported by the data, it is at least one of the highly likely possibilities to occur, you say, what are the key success factors that we would need to obtain, essentially, you know, gather in as resources, capabilities, to survive, at least as effectively as we could. And then you go to the next scenario, and you do the same, and the next scenario, and you do the same, and you go to the fourth, and you do the same. And once you're done with that, what you're going to find is that in almost every case, there are key success factors that double up. There's like two of the scenarios that the key success factors, some of them are the same. Sometimes it's even three of the scenarios. There's a subset of the key success factors that are the same. That's what you make your business bets on. Because what you've in essence done is said, I've done all this homework to say, I'm not trying to predict a future. I'm just trying to predict kind of a trajectory that's reasonable. And within that trajectory, I'm not going to try to fight to say this will exactly happen. I will simply bound it and then say, what are the things that, regardless of what happens inside that broader trajectory, what do I need to bet on to be the most successful? Keeps you from betting on edge cases, keeps you from building up capabilities that only work in one particular worldview. It's a great way to kind of, in some ways, as we say, for particularly even smaller organizations, although we do this with large, medium, small, et cetera, the funny way I put it sometimes is this is a much better way to have an offsite than standing over a pizza box and arguing if you're a small company. I mean, no matter the size of the organization, you can do this process. You might need to be coached to do it the first time, but after that, you can do it. We've done it for 300-person organizations up to, you know, multi-billion dollar Fortune 100 organizations, right? So it's a very kind of elastic tool in that regard. And this is the way it might look. You'll basically say, you know, we've got essentially uncertainty on the left. This is obviously kind of an oversimplified one. And uncertainty at the bottom. We define our narratives. We lay out our key success factors. And away we go. And then the other beauty of this is a single slide then. I mean, you have backing data, sure. But this is the slide you update. So when somebody comes to you and says, hey, can you tell me what the market's going to look like, you know, the next 3 months? Or, you know, so-and-so just did this. T-Mobile just launched, as some of you might have heard, like a fairly radical way of selling their phones just yesterday. They're actually going to, you know, sell them unsubsidized, but then almost kind of rent or lease them to you. The details haven't fully been cleared out of everything they're going to do. I think there's a lot of scenarios about how that might play out for them, right? So maybe 3 months from now, if you were tracking that, you could just update a slide and say, here's the update to the scenarios, as opposed to here's the update to a 500-person deck. I mean, a 500-slide deck. So, you know, much better way to communicate this information in the company. And then you can constantly wind tunnel your big question through the scenarios. You can keep saying, you know, here was our question from before. What are we doing today? What have we done that essentially lets us know that we've done the right thing to kind of have the best chance for survival? But let's say you like numbers. Let's say that's the main thing you do, and you'd rather look at kind of a numbers way of dealing with this. Well, there is a way of handling this. I call it dealing with value migration. And the guy Adrian I mentioned earlier, he wrote a book on this, and he talked about the idea of classifying, in this case, publicly traded companies on inflow, outflow, and stability. And he had kind of a dictionary definition for this. He said, after all the research I've done, if you take a look at market cap and divide it by revenue, or EV divided by revenue, in some cases, and you say if the company is, the ratio that you get from that is 2.0 or greater, they're in inflow. If they're in stability, it's between 2.0 and 0.8. And if it's in outflow, it's basically lower than that. And the beauty of this model is we know it happens all the time in industries, right? We know, as Adrian says, that value doesn't disappear, it just evolves, right? We know that, you know, paper map makers, when some of us on this call were kids, somebody would throw a paper into the back seat and say, read this to keep yourself occupied on some long car drive. This was long before we, you know, had iPods and, you know, all the other stuff that you give your kids now, Kindles and everything else, right? My kids are no different. Well, those are kind of dead. I mean, the last time I used a paper map was when I was stuck 50 miles from the nearest cell phone signal camping up in British Columbia. That moved to GPS devices, and the thing that's coming is context-aware computing. I mean, take a look at what they're doing with Google Now on Android devices, if you've taken a look at that recently. You know, this is just the tip of the iceberg of some of the things, and Google's just one of them, right? There's lots of companies kind of working in that space. So everybody knows intuitively that the value moves, right? If you want to know where you are and how to get to the next place, you know, who owns that process? Who helps you do that changes a lot over time, and hence the value for providing that service, who wins the access to that value, and hence that revenue changes over time. So what Adrian said is that you can just put math behind this. And so here's an example of a bunch of companies I'm sure everybody's at least passingly familiar with, at least a good number of them. And what I'm going to do here in the next slide is just, you know, we're getting close to time, and I've got a few more slides. We might have to run to 9:50 before we do Q&A. But, you know, just take a moment and look at it and say, what's my guess? Sean said that 2.0 and above is inflow. 2.0 to 0.8 is stability. And below 0.8 is outflow. So, you know, look at this list and just even take a couple and say, I think this one's going to end up here. So the question is, how close did they end up to one or two that you thought of? And that's the beauty of this model, is that it tells a story in a number. It also does what all good frameworks should do, which is they help you kind of go back through your thinking and say, did I miss something, right? they force you to be a little more honest than you might be otherwise in some other circumstances. Because everyone uses kind of intellectual cheats a little bit, either unintentionally, in the sense that you kind of know a market too well to see it clearly anymore, or sometimes you're just in a hurry and you have to kind of do a little more quick and dirty version of what you want to do to get the analysis out like the next morning. You know, boss calls at 3 p.m. and says, I need something by 8. That's obviously not as rigorous as something that you had 5 days to do. So things like that. And what it helps to have is frameworks that can kind of very quickly paint a picture. VMR is one of those for publicly traded companies. So you look at Microsoft and you say, why are they in inflow? Well, it makes you ask the question. And then you can say, well, they have multiple businesses. Even if Windows 8 isn't doing well at all, even if Windows Phone isn't doing really well at all, they have Microsoft Office as a franchise that still sells a lot of licenses. They have stuff that sells to enterprise customers that has a lot of money attached to it. Apple is obviously doing well. Interestingly enough, this number would be lower than when I put it into this presentation a few months back, because that number is lower now because they've had some pretty decent dips to their stock price. So you could even track that a little bit. Best Buy, the number should be here. They've been infected with showrooming as a disease, right? People go into Best Buy, they touch a few products, see what they like, look, check them out, they walk to their car, and on their way to their car, they use their mobile phone to buy it off Amazon because it's $50 cheaper and they're Prime members and they don't pay for shipping. It's hard if you're Best Buy to deal with that. So you're in a position of outflow. The value of shopping for electronics has transitioned to Amazon. Interesting enough, though, Amazon doesn't have a massively high number because Amazon is a retailer. So Amazon has pretty low margins compared to some of the other guys on this list. So it makes sense that they wouldn't have as high a number as Apple, nor may they ever be able to get there because they just can't capture the value the same way an Apple can, because Apple has so much higher margins on their hardware. So, and obviously somebody like BlackBerry should be in the basement like they are. So one last framework I just want to briefly touch on and then do some closing thoughts is, it's another really important one to kind of have in your toolbox, is dealing with what's called crossing the chasm. The reason I always want to talk about this one is that it kind of got a bad name in some ways by the book. And that may seem strange to say, because this is one of the most popular books, actually, business books that's been out there. And I don't have any problem with the book. What I have a problem is that Jeffrey took Crossing the Chasm, which talked about the technology adoption lifecycle, and he applied it so closely to the tech industry and married it all that he kind of left out the fact that it's really the diffusion of innovations theory in many ways. And so it applies to things that aren't just technology. It's almost anything that's almost a disruptor to an industry, you can chart through this. So it's also worth noting that the original diffusion of innovations theory goes all the way back to something, and I think if I recall right, 1942, that was a farming study. So while the book gets popularized on tech, you can use this for a lot of different things, and we have too. So what it basically posits is that when something enters a market that's a disruption, kind of a diffusion of an innovation, right? You basically have these segments that kind of appear in the market almost automatically. And I think people intuitively know this happens, but the trick is to have an actual dictionary way to describe it. So you say, innovators are the first slice of the market. They're followed by early adopters. Notice a much larger slice of the market, almost 4 times the size of the first. Then we've got early majority and late majority. Sometimes these folks are referred to as pragmatists and conservatives. And then you've got the laggards. The key thing to note is that 70% of the market shows up after that initial hill. Now, Moore talked about the fact that there's a chasm between early adopters and pragmatists, and I don't want to run over that because that alone can be a great analysis tool. Asking yourself, is our competitor essentially going to cross the chasm, right? Sure, they're a disruptor. Sure, they've got a lot of momentum. As a matter of fact, it can even be a little hard to tell where they're going because there's this massive slope that they hit usually when they grab that early majority. These are the early adopters who usually have pretty deep pockets, and they're looking for kind of big business impact. They were the first people, not the first people, but kind of the people right after the early adopters to have an iPad. And they were driving their business to adopt them and things like that. Or they were the first ones to pick up a smartphone in kind of the business group, and they got other people to do it. But the challenge is these folks don't really provide a strong reference to the pragmatist crowd. That's what Moore talked about. And that comes down to a little bit of psychology and a little bit of market dynamics. You know, in essence, the people in the early majority, the pragmatists, want to see people like them buying the product. They're not really incented to buy it by people who are the early adopters. And it's not the early adopters' fault necessarily, because the early adopters are looking usually to experiment somewhat, not as much as the innovators, who usually actually, interesting enough, don't have a deep pocket. So that's the classic model of small startup company, has its initial customers that are willing to experiment, but they're not really making a lot of revenue. All of a sudden they hit the early adopters and they're making lots of money because the early adopters are willing to spend. But what they want is a big business benefit. So this is like lots of hand-holding, lots of working with them directly. They want to have an impact on the evolution of the product to some degree. It's all good, but it creates this circumstance where the company gets this huge boost in revenue, your competitor does. But right at that moment, you have to ask yourself, will they cross the chasm? Because if they don't cross the chasm and you're one of the big guys on the other side, it may not really matter all that much that they're trying. Because if they just fall into the chasm and die, which some companies do, then they're not someone worthy of your attention quite the same as someone who clearly looks like they will leap across the chasm and be a threat to you. And Moore talks even more detail about whole product analysis, and you can use frameworks like that to essentially analyze where you are in that versus the competition. But it, you know, there's standardized ways to describe the movement of that competitor through the market slices. Here's an example of the cycle of life, kind of using the iPhone again. As of today, where we stand is that now that we're in the iPhone 5, right, and we've on the fifth evolution of the product, the innovators, the folks who are basically a little bit the mad scientist persona, right, they don't own one computer in their house, they own six, right, and they're always stringing stuff together, right, and they also seem to be doing it on a more limited budget, but they like the exploration process. Well, this is the person who maybe owns a couple phones even today, you know, and they keep telling you why that matters. And they're kind of bored with iPhone 5. Matter of fact, they were probably bored with iPhone 4. And they're really bothered by the Maps issue. Early adopters, they're the folks who are telling you now they might move to Android, or they might get an Android tablet. Right? They're thinking about something new. Whether they make the move or not yet, we don't really know. But what we see here is the market aging on the front end of the iPhone right now. We would draw this graph very differently if we were 3 years ago. But that's kind of what we might be looking at now. The pragmatists, well, they're happy to buy an iPhone because everybody else has one. And same thing with conservatives. And again, there's nothing wrong with being in any camp. It's just the fact that this seems to happen over and over and over again, so you can use it as a modeling tool. The conservatives, well, these folks, they waited to buy an iPhone in some cases till not that long ago. They waited until Apple offered them a cheap $0 version of the phone, like you can get an iPhone, an original iPhone 4, I should say, for $0 now, or an iPhone 4S for $99. These folks are looking for the package deal. They want it to be somewhat economical. Maybe they want a charger packaged with it. They want a decent cell phone packaged with it, and that's fine. And the thing to remember is the pragmatists and the conservatives alone are 70% of the market. So what you can have is a brand and a product that's actually growing a little stale on the front end, but feasting off of the back end. And we've seen this dynamic a number of times. Windows was a product that had a similar experience. But every industry goes through this. Airline brands seem to go through kind of evolutions like this, where they're kind of the darling of the front end, and then they become mainstream, and everybody wants to fly them, and then they kind of fall off the back end. Last but not least, not to leave off the laggards, these are the folks you know that proudly tell you they have a feature phone. You know, if I sound a little derisive about that, I do think everybody should have a smartphone, but that's just a small stump speech. So a final word, avoiding stall points. So why does all this matter, right? I mean, beyond all the other reasons we talked about, why would you do it? Well, there was this great book called Stall Points that was just out a couple years ago, and they did this great analysis on companies and what happens to them after they stall, which they defined as this significant revenue decline measured against 10 years of trailing, and I won't go into the algorithm. You can read it about it in the book. But it was well thought out, and they had a nice workbook of questions that you can walk your organization through, a really nice piece of kind of business research. And they said the biggest thing that killed these companies, they could summarize in a sentence was, it's what they knew that was no longer so. And I don't know if I could come up with a better definition sometimes of what people do in CI and strategy work. I mean, our goal is to basically say, what do you no longer know? I mean, what do you know that's no longer so? And it's okay to come back with analysis that says, you know, well, it's still the same. I mean, that's okay, right? I mean, you know, you hope to find stuff that's different, but occasionally the real answer is you're still in a good position, market is strong for you, and you've got some room to maneuver, right? That's fair too. But what this book said is that when the stall point happens, most of the time the organizations were caught unaware. And worse yet, most organizations fell very quickly, hence the rocks like gliders. Interestingly enough, they talked about the three stall categories, the three top ones. Basically, position captivity, innovation management breakdown, premature core abandonment. These all map in many ways to some of the frameworks we talked about. For example, if you're unable to shift tactics in response to a low-cost competitor or changing customer preferences, that relates to the innovator's dilemma, value migration, crossing the chasm, scenario planning. You can even pick up some of this stuff from a Porter's by looking at substitutes and new entrants, things like that. And the rest of them also have very good mapping to some of the things we talked about today. So what's next for you? Well, we tell people they've got to build up their pattern recognition toolkit. It's just something that you really have to do to be effective as an analyst. And you can start with a few patterns and a few frameworks and just build up from there. Like I said, you know, this is something that's completely achievable by anybody. There's no mystery to this. You should never feel that there is. You may need a coach. You may need some training. You may need resources. You may need somebody who's kind of excited to mentor you. But at the end of the day, this is completely, achievable kind of thing. Also, research patterns that have worked and those that haven't in the history of business. There's some patterns that are dead now that you shouldn't actually use, so be careful not to use those. And then at some point, you should create your own battle-tested frameworks too. These are some that we've put together too. As a closing thing here, very closing thought, I've got a table here as more of a resource for everyone that basically talks about some questions you might be trying to answer and analysis tools that you might consider. As a little bit of kind of extra credit, I threw in a few other things in here that were ones that we didn't even talk about necessarily today. But there's a set of resources there you can poke around and use for further reading. If you want to get a copy of the presentation or you want to get a copy of the latest edition of our book, just go to CascadesInsights.com request and ask it. If you have the least bit trouble using the form or signing up or whatever, occasionally somebody does if they're using kind of a odd mobile device or whatever, just obviously feel free to email me, Sean@CascadeInsights.com. And with that, I'll wrap up and take any questions.
Sean, thanks again for going through that. And given the time right now, there was one question, however, I think we'll cut it short. Just as a reminder for those who may not have a pen in hand or whatnot, as Sean mentioned, the copy of this presentation will be available on his website. And for those of you who have registered, the audio is being recorded on this and will be available, and B, after this webinar series is done today, a link to pull all the slides as well as the audio will be available to everybody who registered. So thank you very much, Sean. I greatly appreciate it. Given the time right now, it's 12:55 right now. I know that Ellen has already gotten on and wanted to just allow a few minutes for transition for those who may have paid attention the whole time and need to run to the restroom. So again, thanks again, Sean, and we'll now leave about 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll get started with Ellen's presentation.